And welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am your host, Chip Patterson, joined, as always, on this fine Sunday afternoon by Tom Fornelli. Tom, I'm sorry that the Bears did not get it done against Detroit, but hopefully you're ready to pick yourself up and talk about some Week 5.
Everybody should be fired. Jay Cutler should be shot into the sun.
Had a nice overreaction. Very appropriate.
Thank you.
Speaking of overreaction, do you think that Southern California, of course, the news breaking early Sunday morning, just hours after they were done getting beat 62-41 at Arizona State, the Southern California Trojans made the decision to terminate Lane Kiffin as the head coach. We have assistant head coach, recruiting coordinator, defensive line coach Ed Orgeron is going to take over in the interim. Before we get into what happens next or what this means for the Trojans, do you think – I know you we kind of went back and forth on this earlier, and I know you said as much on Twitter, but not exactly the way that you think Kiffin deserved to go.
Yeah, there's been some conflicting reports as to how it actually went down. Like I saw from Scott Wolf that – he was fired at in the parking lot at the airport and basically left behind by the team bus. But then Chris Houston, our old colleague, reported that Lane Kiffin's car was at the airport. He wasn't left behind anywhere. He always drives himself to and from the airport. So, but it just is the way of handling it. I don't really necessarily agree with doing it like that right after a game, after you fly back to LA and you're sitting in the airport and you're like, oh, by the way, you don't need to come into work tomorrow. I mean, I suppose getting fired is getting fired, but getting fired outside of the team bus in front of your team. I know Lane Kiffin has, you know, let's say he's a bit rough around the edges, but that's not really the classiest way, I think, of handling that situation. I think there's much better ways to go about it. And I think USC kind of just repaid Kiffin by acting like Kiffin. And my mom would tell me that's not the right way to do things.
That she believes that you should turn the other cheek instead of trying to do them back the way that you got did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, be the bigger man, I guess, is the way to put it.
Yeah, well, this is obviously – it comes after a very strange game, considering the fact that it was USC's offense that really, really struggled up to this point. And the defense was really what everyone was hanging their hat on. Then all of a sudden, Arizona State just absolutely runs wild. They sort of effortlessly roll up 612 yards of offense. Southern Cal puts up 542 as well, but get four turnovers. Huge game from Trey Madden. Trey Madden and Justin Davis, great running back duo that is unfortunately lost in the midst of all this craziness. We've got a Marquise Lee injury. Just not a good world for the Trojans right now. Do you think it's possible for Orgeron to salvage what's left of the season, or do you think that this is going to be just sort of a car wreck for the rest of the year?
I think with the talent on the roster, anything's possible. I mean, I don't think we're talking Pac-12 title, but I mean, I think 7-8 wins is definitely doable as far as talent is concerned. But I do fear a train wreck because these players know that, you know, odds are Orgeron won't be there next year.
Right.
Odds are none of the coaches on that coaching staff are going to be there next year. So what real motivation to, like, particularly the seniors, what the hell do they have, you know, to – they don't care. It's obvious it's done to them. So you have to worry about, you know, maybe the players quitting on the season and just, you know, saying screw it. So I think it could get very ugly. There's definitely a possibility of it, but I still think that USC is going to be going to a bowl game.
There's a lot of talent there, and I think if I was a USC fan, I'd be worried about two things. A, the NFL talent just kind of already eyeing May and the process leading up to that. And then, of course, the assistant coaches that are left there spending some time getting their resumes together. This is a frequent complaint. I think sometimes it is handed out unfairly, but I think you've heard of enough instances to at least be concerned if you're a USC fan that pretty much everyone on that roster that can get you to 8 wins or possibly more is going to be checked out.
But I mean, let's look at it as an example from last night too. Marquise Lee hurt his knee last night. We don't know the severity of it. You know, it's apparently a sprain of some sort. We don't know if it's a ligament sprain or just a joint sprain or whatever. But if you're Marquise Lee, are you risking your knee?
No.
Are you risking for this team this year? No.
For what? For who?
Yeah, you've got the NFL on the horizon, and I know that sounds selfish, and we like to think of, you know, these college student athletes as selfless, you know, all for the. But let's be real. I mean, your coach has already been fired.
Yeah.
And you've got the NFL on the horizon, so why would you risk yourself at this point? So, yeah, I think we could see quite a bit of that.
As far as where USC goes from here, the early list of possible candidates, according to Bruce Feldman, he put together a nice list of just names that are going to pop up. But likely, I think that this is something that we will not get another development on for a while, especially when you consider that Kevin Sumlin, Chris Peterson, and Steve Sarkisian are near the top of the list. You got James Franklin, Jack Del Rio's with the Broncos right now, Pat Fitzgerald, and then all the way down to Tim DeReuter, Fresno State's coach, and San Francisco offensive coordinator Greg Roman. Those are just sort of the speculation of some of the names that Bruce put together. Any of those stand out to you that you think might be more or less likely?
Well, Feldman mentioned Chris Peterson saying that he's heard from people that Peterson's looking to, you know, maybe get a fresh start somewhere. But he also mentions that he's not sure that USC being in that spotlight is typically the kind of place that Chris Peterson would be interested in. But I think James Franklin would probably go for the job if offered, because he's done great at Vanderbilt. In, you know, relative, he's done great at Vanderbilt, but it'd be hard to turn down USC to stay in Nashville. So I think if the job came to James Franklin, he'd go for it. I think Greg Roman could be a good higher-up. He comes from that Harbaugh tree, you know. I don't really think Jack Del Rio is a realistic target. I don't think USC is really interested going that route. So I don't know. And you look at Steve Sarkisian, and you fired, you know, Lane Kiffin for putting up mediocre results. And while Washington's off to a great start this year, Steve Sarkisian's yet to win 8 games in a season in Washington.
Yeah. So,
I mean, you see this initial list of targets, and it's to be honest, it's a bit lackluster.
The classic USC job search line is that they always want to keep it in the family. But another key detail of Feldman's report is that he has heard that they are willing to look a little more outward, which would bring in somebody like a James Franklin if they want to stay in-house. That's when I think you're talking about Sarkisian as the front runner.
Speaking, I figured it out.
What?
Saban.
Yeah, it's definitely Saban.
Saban's going to USC, Chip. You heard it here first on the Ion College
Breaking News. Speaking of Steve Sarkisian, Oregon, Stanford, and Washington combined to beat their opponents 141-46, average margin of victory of 31.6 points. And really, that is pulled down by Washington's 18-point win. Really heavy rain in all three of those games. Did you have anything that you could take away other than they're all way better than their Pac-12 competition?
Yeah, the Pac-12 has been really good to start the year, and there's a lot of good teams in that conference, but I think those games yesterday kind of proved that the conference, like just about everybody else, is extremely top-heavy, and once you get to the middle to the bottom, there's a lot of crap. And I think that became evident, even though with nice starts from Washington State, Colorado, and Arizona this season, they got exposed pretty good.
Yeah, yesterday. Yeah, this is these three teams that we suspected were going to be like competing there for the North and could be really good. Yeah, they're all way better than the teams they played yesterday.
There's a huge gap between the top tier teams in that conference and everybody else, and that's what I learned yesterday, or at least confirmed.
Yeah, exactly. All right, now moving away from the Pac-12, and you know, this is another instance, as we've had on this podcast before, where we leave Saturday night and, you know, my plan is we're going to be talking about X game. And this is, of course, the Georgia-LSU instant classic. But then, of course, Kiffin gets fired. So now finally getting to a really, really awesome game. Really happy that we got to see another sort of slugfest. But It points out the fun that that everyone has realized that the myth of SEC defenses has not really occurred in some of these marquee matchups. Alabama, of course, winning 49-42 against Texas A&M, and then Georgia winning 44-41 yesterday. The first one was Manziel and McCarron, and this one was Murray and Mettenberger. So what'd you think of this second round of the Battle of the M's?
Oh, my God. I just realized every quarterback's name begins with an M in that conference.
Yeah.
You know what I would love to do? I would love to take the box scores from this game and the Texas A&M and Alabama game and go back in time a few years to all the SEC fans 3 years ago who would tell everybody that points don't matter, it's the defense and blah, 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 and the SEC is always going to be a real man's league because they played real defense. And I'd like to show them these box scores.
Yeah.
Just be like, so how about that real man's league stuff? But no, this was a fantastic game. It was terrible defense. Well, actually, you know what? Honestly, the defense wasn't that bad. I think it was Aaron Murray and Zach Mettenberger both playing very well because
they both had some, like, they were the receivers were not wide open on all of these completions as they just went through and racked up ridiculous yards.
Yeah, there were definitely some mistakes on defense by the secondaries on both teams, but a lot of the times it was just they were getting beat by really good throws. So I think it's probably unfair to say it was all bad defense. And Georgia's had a nice pass rush. They got to Mettenberger four times. So there was defense played. It was just there's a lot of really good offense between plays. So it was an excellent game. I enjoy this SEC. I mean, it's taking all the best parts from like the Pac-12 and the Big 12 of the super fun happy times that we've seen the last few years, and it's combining it with like a supreme talent edge over the rest of college football. And it's fun as hell to watch.
Yeah, and when Jordan Jenkins tees off on pass, you know, from the outside coming in to rush Mettenberger, you know, that still looks like the SEC defense of old. It's just the fact that we've got, you know, outstanding wide receivers getting downfield, and especially in this matchup, you've got two experienced quarterbacks going up against very inexperienced secondaries on both sides. We knew that about Georgia, particularly because of the Clemson and South Carolina games. We did not necessarily see that youth exposed again for LSU until now, just because of the competition, including Lawson, who is one of their most experienced safeties. He was out, and so I think Eugene came in there. And I think that with young secondary, with not much pass rush, I mean, it was a really, really fun game of 7-on-7 that sort of showcased this weird SEC year, which is dominated by quarterbacks.
Yeah, it's not your grandpa's SEC.
No, certainly not. All right, now let's see. What does a bully do? Do you think that a good bully is somebody that just is going to come out and beat you up? Or do you think a good bully is somebody that's going to, like, just sit on you and just absolutely let everything, all the weight down and just wait until you pass out?
I think the good bully is going to invite the hyped up newcomer over to his house. And then when it gets there, it's just going to pummel them for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And although, yeah, I don't know if Alabama, it wouldn't call it a pummeling from the outset because they didn't really get going to the second half. And even then, it wasn't exact offensive showcase. But I think the questions about Alabama's defense were somewhat settled.
Yeah.
Because I know we may have overhyped Ole Miss, I think, because of the recruiting rankings and their start. People tended to overhype what was going on with the Rebels. But still, there's a lot of talent on that offense. And it came into Tuscaloosa and managed 200 yards on the day. And no points, didn't find the end zone. Turned the ball over only twice. They averaged 3.6 yards per play, 1.8 yards per rush. I think Alabama's defense is just fine.
Yeah, no, this was – a game where coming into it, I felt like if Ole Miss sits out there, gets a couple plays, has a couple things go their way, and the Alabama win was just so typical of the type of Alabama win I think that makes Nick Saban happy. I think that this Ole Miss game is what he wants football to be, which is going to be to suffocate you. I mean, this was like the 21-0 BCS title win over LSU. That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, I mean, Ole Miss didn't really have any hope at any point in that game. There wasn't even like a glimmer. It's even when they were only down 3-0 after the first quarter and then 9-0 going into halftime, you felt like they were down 30 points because they couldn't move the ball.
South Carolina loses Connor Shaw but escapes with a win against Central Florida. Dylan Thompson comes in. I think they've got Shaw out, what, 2 weeks?
I think that's what I heard, about 2-3 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, you got Shaw out 2 weeks. Brandon Wilds, backup running back, out 3 weeks. It is a good thing that Mike Davis is in there running as well as he has been. 26 carries, 167 yards, 3 touchdowns in the win. Can South Carolina continue to ride Mike Davis, which has really sort of been the best form of offense? Damir Bird and Bruce Ellington seem to come up with big plays, but it's not necessarily a reliable threat at wide receiver. Can the good defense and Mike Davis, are they going to be able to run the table? Because that's really the only hope for South Carolina now if they want to hop back into that East race.
Yeah, the good news for the Gamecocks is, even with Connor Shaw getting hurt, is that they're used to Connor Shaw getting hurt. This isn't anything new for South Carolina to have to figure out how to deal with, because Shaw gets hurt at least once a year. So as far as Mike Davis is concerned, if you look at South Carolina's schedule, I mean, they've gotten past Georgia already, and the only two real tough games that I'm concerned about, I think the road trip to Arkansas could be difficult, but I don't think it's too much for the Gamecocks, but the game against Florida and the game against Clemson to finish the year. Now, the Clemson game doesn't really affect the SEC standings, but that Florida game, at least it's in Columbia. I don't know if Mike Davis will be enough for them to get past the Gators.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that Florida run defense, it's stout. So I think that they would need to be healthy and have Connor Shaw back and have the receivers make some plays if they're going to win that game. But for the most part, I think Mike Davis is good enough to get him through the rest of this conference schedule, aside from that game.
Yeah, I think they're going to need to be able to be a little bit more diverse if they want to have hope against Florida. And, of course, that Florida game, one that they have to win. Florida gets a big day from Matt Jones, 176 yards, as he goes on to outgain the entire Kentucky team. What do you think about the Gators? Obviously, we just talked about that South Carolina matchup. Do you think that they are – what would you say for the Georgia game if you were to set that line right now?
I'd give Georgia about 4 or 5 points.
But you would expect it to still be close enough that it's a toss-up straight up? Like you would have trouble deciding it? Or do you think that Georgia is a markedly better team?
I would lean Georgia just because I feel like Florida's defense is great, and it's much better than Georgia's. But it's just I feel like Georgia's offense is so much further ahead than Florida's offense that I'd have to give them the edge there, because I think, you know, Florida's defense can only do so much to stop that Georgia attack between Aaron Murray and then Gurley, if he's healthy in time, and Marshall. There's just so much that Georgia can do to you on offense. I feel like they'll be able to exploit Florida a little bit, not destroy, but I think they could get to 20-some-odd points, and I don't know that Florida would get to 20-something against Georgia. So I'd lean Georgia right now.
Trey Williams, Trey Carson, Ben Molina, Johnny Manziel, and Mike Evans make a handful of absolutely dominant playmakers on Texas A&M's offense. And we saw them put up 42 against Alabama, continue to score. The A&M defense allows Alex Collins to go for 116. This is the fourth straight game. Alex Collins' entire collegiate career is spent running for 100 yards, which is awesome, and he's incredible. But this crew of Texas A&M players, if they're all healthy and they're all out there, I don't know if there's really a defense in college football that could stop them. It only is circumstance, like, for example, in the Alabama game, Alabama got out to the lead and they just continued to keep scoring. You know, they didn't ever really stop Manziel down the stretch. And I don't know what team would be able to stop this A&M offense down the stretch. What would you think would happen if Baylor and A&M play each other?
You'd get like a 6-hour game. I think it would take forever. I think it would get pretty boring after about the first. I mean, everybody thinks I'd be exciting, but I'm guessing by halftime, everybody would be bored out of their mind, because it'd be like watching, you know, be like playing your friend on Madden and Rookie, because all you would do is score every damn play. But No, I think Texas A&M has tons of playmakers on offense, like you were saying, and I think they need them because this just feels like a team to me that if it's not scoring 40 points, it's probably going to lose.
Yeah. What's all right? So Texas A&M and LSU, both. You know, that will be, in my mind, obviously
it's going to be another shootout.
LSU has to beat Alabama to even make this a conversation, but LSU, what's your sort of takeaway after seeing them here in this final test? Mettenberger, really, really strong performance, goes 23 for 37, averages 10 yards per attempt, 3 touchdowns, most importantly, 0 interceptions. Do you think that they would be able to hang in there and go just get in another shootout with Texas A&M?
Yeah, I mean, LSU, it's not like, you know, they lost that game yesterday, but it's aside from the defense struggling, which isn't a shock, but you can't really be upset with anything that happened in that game as far as LSU is concerned, because it was on the road against a very good team, and they lost by 3 points. They came up just short, you know what I mean? The clock ran out on them.
Yeah.
But LSU is still in a good position because it's got a lot of tough games left on its schedule, make no mistake. But they still control their own destiny, because the only undefeated team left in the West Division is Alabama, and LSU still gets to play Alabama, and yes, it's in Tuscaloosa, but they still control their own destiny. And then but it's not going to be easy. I still think LSU is probably the second best team in that division. I think they'll beat Texas A&M even with the problems we saw in LSU's secondary yesterday. I still think they're good enough to beat Texas A&M. So I do. I think it's all going to come down to that game against Alabama on November 9th.
Moving after, whew, that was exhausting. Got all the SEC out of our system.
Yeah. Oh, God.
All right.
Can we talk about some crappy Big Ten football, please?
Yeah, we can. But it was, hey, before, don't say crappy Big Ten football, when we really did have a very entertaining Ohio State-Wisconsin game. I was very excited. You and I both were about the potential for this game to be awesome. And I think it lived up to the hype, absolutely. My only disappointment is Melvin Gordon getting injured.
Yeah, it kind of took some of the fun out of it. But even to be fair, before he got hurt, Ohio State was doing a pretty good job of bottling him up. So I don't know if it would have had a huge impact if he'd have stayed healthy.
Yeah, no, that was only my disappointment for the game. Just like literally when the game was over, I was like completely satisfied.
Yeah, I just
except
hope,
for
yeah,
the fact,
just
yeah,
hope
I just hope
okay
he's okay.
So he can play
yeah.
next week.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so no, it was a very good game. Wisconsin, you know, actually before it was over, actually did outgained Ohio State in offense both per play and total yards wise. So the comeback was a bit too late. They just got a bit too far behind, and the mountain was too steep to climb after they got down 31-14 in the third quarter. So it was obvious that those were the two best teams in the Big Ten last night, and I feel like that win pretty much stamps Ohio State's ticket to Indianapolis, and the only question at this point is who are they going to play? Although it is Ohio State, so going on the road against Purdue, you know, people talk about Clemson and Florida State. Ohio State tends to have trouble with Purdue and Illinois in seasons like this too, so he probably shouldn't take this too much for granted.
I think Joel Stavi deserves a rousing mm-hmm. round of applause for showing up to play, because I came into this game expecting to be all Melvin Gordon, James White, and all over the place. And sure enough, Joel Stavi completes 20 of 34, 295 yards, 2 touchdowns, but it's 10 of those passes connect with
Jared
Abracadabra. Yeah. For 207 yards and a touchdown. Really great performance by Aberderis. Do you have any concerns for Ohio State's defense? I think they did a great job stopping the run. That's what they were prepared to do.
Yeah.
They had to come in and say, you know what, if you're going to be successful against us, it's going to have to be Joel Stavi. So I don't discredit Ohio State. I credit Stavi for showing up.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, it was clear that Ohio State's game plan going into last night's game was to take away Wisconsin's running attack, because that's what Wisconsin does, and it's what Wisconsin's great at. It says, if they're going to beat us, let's force Stavi to do it. And like you said, all credit goes to Stavi, because he nearly did do it. But a lot of that was because Ohio State's game plan on defense was, you know, they were giving him room to throw because they'd rather have him doing that and hoping he couldn't get the job done. But he got the job done, and I'm not really worried about Ohio State's defense going in the long run because it's still pretty mean and it's still pretty nasty. And the secondary is like the weak link of that defense, but it's still one of the better units in that conference. So I don't think it's going to be, you know, it's going to kill them before the year's over or anything.
Braxton Miller had a couple of those just really dirty moments, and I'm starting to think that in terms of being a BCS title contender, Ohio State has kind of that spotlight team vibe where because of all this success under Urban Meyer, particularly with this unit, for the most part, they almost can feel the light switch. Like, you know, the good teams that aren't necessarily – Ohio State isn't to that point yet where they're going to go out and crush every team they play. But when they get tested and they need to turn it on, Braxton Miller can do some really ridiculous stuff with the ball. Or, like, the defense will all this – like, Bradley Roby comes up with some ridiculous play. Like, there's they seem like a team that can sort of flip a switch right now. Your only concern, particularly in the BCS title sense, is what happens when they get down by too much and flipping the switch doesn't help.
Yeah, I think that's why I worried about that Purdue-Illinois game, is because you're right. It's they are kind of a play-your-level team at times, but I do think in moments like this, particularly with – I think Braxton's great all the time. I think the rest of the team, though, kind of tends to coast when it can.
Yeah. So, sim to next play? They keep,
yeah, pretty
they
much.
Keep simming till next time on field?
Yes. You just get the feeling sometimes from some of the guys that it's like, you know, we're Ohio State. We're going to win this game. And yeah. they sometimes act a bit too much like it. Where I don't put that on Braxton, though. I think Braxton's pretty much Braxton every damn play.
Tom.
Yo.
So tell me a little bit about Illinois. So they kind of ran crazy in the second quarter. But should we be taking this Fighting Illini team seriously? They did not make it into my top 30. And you may call me a hater. but what do you think what do you think the legitimate ceiling for this team is? You know, like what are you expecting? Is this a 7-win team?
They should not be in your top 30, so it's a good thing you didn't put them in there. No, I think this is a 6-win team at best, to be honest with you. I think that bowl eligibility should be the ultimate goal for this Illinois team, and they're halfway there, but now conference play starts, and considering that they've got the 14-game conference losing streak, It's hard to see them getting 3 wins in conference play, particularly with Wisconsin still being strong and Ohio State still being strong and a road trip to Penn State. And then they get both Indiana and Purdue on the road. So the winnable games are both on the road. I think if you're comparing this team to last year's team, it's light years ahead of where it used to be, you know, that 2-10 win team, because they could put points on the board this year. The defense is still very questionable, but the offense has been fantastic under Bill Cubitt, their new offensive coordinator. But as far as how good this team could be, if it finishes 6-6, I think they should, you know, party in Champaign.
Are they better than Iowa?
No. I think defensively Iowa has a distinct advantage over Illinois right now.
And then Minnesota, what, better than Minnesota?
I'd say they're about the same at this point as Minnesota. I think Minnesota might have a little bit more talent, but I think Minnesota's schedule is pretty brutal at the same time. So I think Illinois might end up with a better record than Minnesota, but I don't know if I'd call them the better team.
There's a lot of teams in the Big Ten right now that I do not think are a threat to your Northwestern, Ohio State, Wisconsin, you know, Michigan,
no.
Michigan State, but all very intrigued because I know that only about half of them are going to be bowl teams at the end of the year, and I'm not sure which ones they're going to be.
Yeah, no, there's going to be some jockeying for position for them 6th and 7th and 8th bowl games in the conference.
Oh, man, those are the sexiest ones.
Aren't they?
All right, so let's go hunting and fishing with Dana and Tricky Clint Trickett. I think I did tell you on this podcast, and I put this in a note to my email to you. I say on the podcast that I wasn't really sure why I didn't like Oklahoma State? Can I take credit for just having a sneaking suspicion that they were just going to get beat by a team that they should have clobbered?
Listen, you did say that, so I'll credit you for that. But I said in the preseason that there's no way in hell this Oklahoma State team should be ranked as high as it was because it hadn't proven anything yet. And it came into this game ranked 11th, and it still really hadn't proven anything. Yeah, it had played well, but who'd it beaten? So, I mean, I wasn't shocked that they lost this game because I just feel like this is what the Big 12 is this year. I think there's so much parity in this league where I think Baylor right now is the best team in the league, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you I don't fully expect Baylor to lose a game or two.
Yeah.
And part of me still is pretty convinced that Oklahoma is the best team in this conference.
West Virginia really could have won this game by even more if they were able to convert inside the red zone. They ended up settling for a lot of field goals. Clint Trickett, man, I think he did a pretty serviceable job at the quarterback position.
I love Clint Trickett's final stat line because he threw for over 300 yards, which you're like, hell yeah, Clint Trickett. But he completed less 48% than 50% of his passes.
And threw two picks.
Yeah, so I think we should call that kind of box score the Trickett. I think we should honor it. If you can throw for 300 yards while throwing more interceptions than touchdowns and completing less than half your passes, that's something that should be recognized.
We should be celebrating that.
Yes.
So I think the reason Holgorsen sticks with Clint Trickett, at least judging by his comments after the game, he didn't get to see in practice Clint Trickett ever really taking hits. And I think that Clint Trickett, with his experience, you know, he gets out there and he's just down to play some ball. And I think that's what you see in the stat line. It's kind of like, you know what? Let's just get out there and sling the old bean around. And so the fact that he can, you know, break through pressure, shed some tackles, keep the play alive, those are things you don't really see in practice just because they normally are protecting the quarterback. So I guess that this will be funny. It'll be great because Clint Trickett is a blackjack quarterback for Dana Holgorsen. And now the West Virginia team, they could go 5-4 in Big 12 play, or they could go 2-7 and anywhere in between. And yeah. I have no idea.
I'm leaning closer to 2-7 than 5-4. I'd like to go on the record of saying that.
Hey, Clint Trickett will hit on 17. That's what I know. Well, you mentioned
there are fours, threes, and twos in the deck, so one of them's going to show up, right?
You mentioned Oklahoma, and I agree with you. They ended their 7-game losing streak to Notre Dame, and they did so really thanks to two very early interceptions. Brian Kelly after the game saying the turnovers were too much for us to overcome. The Sooners D also produces a touchdown, and I'm asking you, is the defense carrying this team?
Yeah, I mean, the offense did not play poorly yesterday, but I feel like the defense has set the tone for the Sooners this season for the most part. And I do think the offense is finding its groove under Blake Bell. I think, you know, Bell, he didn't have the same kind of passing game yesterday that he did against Tulsa, but he still completed over 70% of his passes and he had 230 yards, two touchdowns. He didn't turn the ball over. So I think the Sooners are finally figuring it out on offense, but no, the defense is still leading the way.
I think it's interesting because we've got some names that aren't necessarily nationally sort of in the conversation, and guys that maybe it's time to start paying a little bit closer attention to on that Sooners defense. In the secondary, you got guys like Zach Sanchez, Jordan Phillips, Charles Tapper on the defensive line. I see these names and, you know, I almost feel like I need to educate myself and pay a little bit more attention to the Sooners defense, because as the rest of the Big 12 is crumbling, Blake Bell and the little bit of the talent they have on offense, Blake Bell's familiarity with the wide receivers, completing a lot of his passes, also continuing to be a rushing threat. You know, if this defense shows up, maybe these are some names we need to be mentioning more often.
Well, you know what's going to happen now?
They're going to get both blown
out. Yeah, we were both on here talking up USC's defense last week. And look what happened.
We are now cursing them. I'm sorry, yeah. Oklahoma fans.
Oklahoma is going to give up like 60 to TCU next week. We're just going to be sitting there like, yeah, we knew they sucked the whole time.
All right, let's real quickly note on Notre Dame before we move to the ACC, which is kind of Notre Dame's home, at least partially next year. What's your idea for the rest of the season for Notre Dame? Tommy Rees continues to get out there and do his little Tommy Rees dance a little bit, completes only 9 of 24 passes, and he was getting hounded. He only was sacked once by Oklahoma's pass rush, but they were doing a great job of getting after him, and obviously they intercepted him three times. 4.3 yards per attempt, 37% completion percentage.
That trick, it is hard to pull off. He tried, but he came up about 200 yards short.
He couldn't get the win, and he couldn't get the 300 yards. I mean, how far can Notre Dame go this season with their struggles on offense and a defense that I think a lot of – you pointed this out. Some people try to circle the loss of Teo, but it's just a little bit of inexperience as well, particularly in the back seven. It's great to have those big boys along the defensive line, but with some inexperience, it's just not the same Notre Dame Fighting Irish defense we saw last year.
No, it's not close to the same. They're giving up plays that they're not making the plays that they made with regularity last season. You know, they got off the field on third downs last year. They're not doing a very good job of that this year. And it's not as good of a team overall. And I don't think the offense is helping matters because Tommy Rees, as we were talking about, the defense's best friend at times is, you know, an offense that's competent. And a lot of the time this year, Notre Dame's offense has not been competent. Tommy Rees is turning the ball over too often. He's putting the defense in bad positions, and they're on the field too much. So this is a team that, you look at their schedule, I mean, they've got Arizona State next week, which Arizona State, as we saw what they did to USC, they got Lane Kiffin fired, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And then, after speaking of Lane Kiffin, the week after that, they've got USC. So this is a team, like I said last week, I think 8-4 is really the ceiling because they've still got Stanford to play this year. You know, it's
UCLA is not going to be they're no slouch.
No, so this is an 8-4 team, 7-5, 8-4. I think I think that's the ceiling.
Florida State.
Oh, but by the way, 8-4 for Notre Dame is probably good enough for a BCS bowl game.
Florida State withstands a scare from Boston College. Boston College jumps out to a 17-3 lead. Jameis Winston responds by going 6-for-6 for 166 yards and 3 touchdowns in the second quarter, including a beautiful 55-yard Hail Mary as time expired for halftime. Clemson, on the other hand, absolutely picks apart Wake Forest. They leave no chance for a scare. I think Bruce Feldman, he said on Twitter, you know, maybe we should be calling this the ACC Atlantic King. Point being, Florida State and Clemson, two teams, both in the top 10, continue to be on this kind of destination crash course for when they play in Death Valley on October 19th. How much space do you think that is there between Florida State, Clemson, and then Miami, who's number 15 in the polls, and would you even put Virginia Tech in that mix?
I think that there's quite a bit of space, you know, between Clemson, Florida State, and then Miami. I think Miami's off to a good start, but I'm not really convinced that this is a team that's quite on the echelon that Florida State and Clemson would be. And then Virginia Tech, what can you really say about Virginia Tech? I mean, it's not a very good team, but it wins. And I feel like that's been the case with the Hokies for a long time. Although the wins haven't been as easy to come by in recent years, it's just they figure out ways to win. They're not really very pretty doing it. But I think that if, like we were talking about this earlier, off before the podcast, if Virginia Tech wins the Coastal Division, I don't think either of us are surprised.
Nope, not one bit. A lot of experience along the defensive line, just on the defense in general.
Yeah, defense is carrying that team.
Yeah, and Logan Thomas is a phenomenal athlete with a lot of talent, and while sometimes the mechanics, he doesn't get help from himself, he hurts himself, sometimes he does not get any help from his receivers, who tend to have a little bit of the case of the drops sometimes. His offensive line is held together often by duct tape. Yep. So the offensive struggles, the solid defense, I just feel like Virginia Tech can go up against anyone. I mean, they gave Alabama a scare. Alabama needed three Christian Jones touchdowns, two of them in special teams, and a pick six touchdown to be able to escape there. Not escape. I mean, they crushed Virginia Tech the other side of the ball, but I don't know. I think Virginia Tech is closer to Miami. And the thing, Tom, here's the thing about Miami. I feel like Miami relies on the home run play far too often. Their really only offensive success in the big win against Florida was on a deep pass to Philip Dorsett, and I think one or two other really big plays. For the most part, against South Florida, a team that is really borderline FBS, you know, maybe should be relegated to the FCS right now, they did not have a ton of success. And I know Stephen Morris, he said that they were playing dirty and he re-injured his ankle and Duke Johnson took a couple shots, but they really have left something to be desired offensively when you consider the talent there. And that's made me think that they're sort of slipping down closer to Virginia Tech, and that this conference is once again sort of Florida State and Clemson, such that they could both be in BCS bowls at the end of the season, depending on how they go against their in-state rivals from the SEC.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe South Florida did play dirty, but is that why Miami turned the ball over four times?
Yeah.
So, no, I agree. I think Miami's a good team. I think it's definitely – it deserves to be ranked, but it's not anywhere near Clemson and Florida State's level.
East Carolina, I think
– sorry, Chip.
East Carolina just absolutely beat the tar out of North Carolina, pun intended. And I think North Carolina – it is this season is troublesome right now. North Carolina fans hear these quotes from players talking about complacency, how they felt like no one was really taking the game seriously. East Carolina comes into town. Lincoln Riley, former Texas Tech quarterback, ECU's offensive coordinator, just really puts together a fantastic game plan, carves up the North Carolina defense as they score on 9 of 12 possessions, and they run 101 plays, which is the second most of any team in FBS play. I've got North Carolina out of the Coastal Division title contention. I'm sort of booting them. And then Georgia Tech with the loss to Virginia Tech, I'm booting them. So in terms of the eliminator for ACC, I'm pretty much just down to Miami, Virginia Tech, Florida State, and Clemson.
What about Pitt?
Pitt? We'll see how things go against Virginia Tech. That's that. I told you that'll be a rock fight.
No, I'm telling you, what if Pitt beats Virginia Tech? What happens?
I don't know. We all say go ACC. any other sort of sleeper teams or anything that stood out to you as we wind down these final minutes of the Rewind podcast?
The American still sucks really bad outside of Louisville and UCF, doesn't it?
Yeah.
This is a conference that's still, you know, technically a BCS conference, and they've got 3-0-4 teams in it. So that's
UConn. UConn's ugly. Really, really bad.
UConn, South Florida, and Temple lost to Idaho? Is that who Temple lost to yesterday?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a good conference. And Louisville, I think Louisville has to go super undefeated to even have a chance, like, to get to the title game with that schedule.
They actually need to go 16-0.
Yeah, they need to play like some NFL teams along the way just to boost up that strength of schedule.
Yeah.
And other than that, I mean, did you stay up all night to watch Fresno State in Hawaii?
I did not. I didn't make it.
So it's hard to comment on that.
Fresno State's the last real hope for a BCS buster.
It's really the only hope. You're right. I mean, well, Northern Illinois still has that shot because it's got the two Big Ten wins. But still, I think after what happened last year in the Orange Bowl, I don't think Northern Illinois is really going to get a chance again. I think Fresno State would get it.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, if you are listening to this on CBSSports.com, just scroll right down and you will see Tom's top 30 for this week as well as my top 30. If you're listening to this on iTunes, then cruise over to CBSSports.com, find the Rewind podcast, and you will get to check those out. We both fill out a top 30 and submit it as part of the calculations for the CBSSports.com 126. I have never filled out an entire 126 team ballot for our bosses.
I could. My formula does. I do all 126 teams. I could give it out if they want me to.
Who's number 125 and 126 right now?
Oh, you put me on. I got to open it up and look real quick. So, you know, let's chat. How you doing today, Chip?
Man, Cal.
Kill time. Right now it is.
Should we talk about Oregon State more? I feel like we haven't talked about Oregon State because they lost that opening game to Eastern Washington.
And no, that just person on Twitter did not respond to us. I think they probably unfollowed us after we made that comment to them yesterday.
I mean, okay, so overtime win at Utah. That's impressive. San Diego State's not very good. Convincing win against Colorado yesterday.
Yeah.
44-17. Sean Mannion is actually one of the best passers statistically in the country right now.
He's been great.
2,000 yards, 21 touchdowns. We got at Washington State, at Cal. If Oregon State is still a one-loss team when they host Stanford,
we will talk about that.
I will be back. I'll be back on the Oregon State train. But
yeah, listen. The Eastern Washington loss, you know, fine. That's opening weekend. That kind of crap happens from time to time. But it's just since then, yes, they've played very well. But aside from that overtime win against Utah, who have they played that's really worth bragging about?
Yeah, and their schedule finishes with Stanford, Southern Cal, Arizona State, Washington, Oregon.
Yep, and USC. USC's in there too, so.
Oregon State fans, keep winning. We'll talk about you.
Exactly. It's not that we don't like you. It's just
we only have but so many minutes. We're already running long.
And we don't want to waste them on your crappy team. That was a joke.
All right, who's 125 and 126, speaking of crappy teams?
Georgia State and FIU.
Oh, FIU. So sad.
Yeah. All right, Darren.
Remember, if you subscribe to the Eye on College Football podcast on iTunes, you will be able to get the podcast actually a little bit early before they hit CBSSports.com. So that should be incentive to do it. For Tom Fornelli, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.